Chapter 22 of My Airships by Alberto Santos Dumont. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. Chapter 22. My Number 9. The Little Runabout. Once I was enamored of high-power petroleum automobiles. They can go at express train speed to any part of Europe, finding fuel in any village. I can go to Moscow or Lisbon, I said to myself. But when I discovered that I did not want to go to Moscow or to Lisbon, the small and handy electric runabout in which I do my errands about Paris and the Bois proved more satisfactory. Speaking from the standpoint of my pleasure and convenience as a Parisian, my airship experience has been similar. When the balloon and motor of my 60-horsepower number 7 were completed, I said to myself, I can race any airship that is likely to be built. But when I found that, in spite of the forfeits I paid into the Aero Club's treasury, there was no one ready to race with me, I determined to build a small airship runabout for my pleasure and convenience only. In it, I would pass the time while waiting for the future to bring forth competitions worthy of my racecraft. So I built my number 9, the smallest of possible dirigibles, yet very practical indeed. As originally constructed, its balloon's capacity was but 220 cubic meters, or 7,070 cubic feet, permitting me to take up less than 30 kilograms, or 66 pounds, of ballast, and thus I navigated it for weeks without inconvenience. Even when I enlarged its balloon to 261 cubic meters, or 9,218 cubic feet, the balloon of my number 6, in which I won the Deutsch Prize, would have made almost 3 of it, while that of my omnibus is fully 8 times its size. As I have already stated, its 3-horsepower Clement motor weighs but 12 kilograms, or 26.5 pounds. With such a motor, one cannot expect great speed. Nevertheless, this handy little runabout takes me over the Bois at between 20 and 25 kilometers, or 12 and 15 miles per hour, and this notwithstanding its egged shape form, see figure 15, which would seemingly be little calculated for cutting the air. Indeed, to make it respond promptly to the rudder, I drive it thick end first. I have said that, as it was originally proportioned, the balloon of this smallest of possible dirigibles permitted me to take up less than 30 kilograms, or 66 pounds, of ballast. As now enlarged, its lifting power is greater, but when account is taken of my own weight and the weight of keel, motor, screw, and machinery, the whole system becomes neither lighter nor heavier than the surrounding atmosphere when I have loaded it with 60 kilograms or 132 pounds of ballast. And it is just in this connection that it will be easiest to explain why I have called this little airship very practical. On Monday, 29th of June 1903, I landed with it on the grounds of the Aero Club at St. Cloud in the midst of 6 inflated spherical balloons. After a short call, I started off again. "Can we not give you some gas?" politely asked my fellow clubman. "You saw me coming all the way from Neuilly," I replied. "Did I throw out any ballast?"
"You threw out no ballast," they admitted.
"Then why should I be in need of gas?" As a matter of scientific curiosity, I may relate that I did not either lose or sacrifice a cubic foot of gas or a single pound of ballast that whole afternoon. Nor has that experience been at all exceptional in the very practical little number 9, or even in its predecessors. It will be remembered that on the day succeeding the winning of the Deutsch Prize, my chief mechanician found that the balloon of my number 6 would take no gas because none had been lost. After leaving my fellow clubmen at St. Cloud that afternoon, I made a typically practical trip. To go from Neuilly-Saint-Jean to the Aero Club grounds, I had already passed the Seine. Now, crossing it again, I made the café-restaurant of the Cascade, where I stopped for refreshments. It was by this time 5 p.m., Not wishing to return yet to my station, I crossed the Seine for a third time and went in a straight course as close to the great fort of Mount Valérien as delicacy permitted. Then, returning, I traversed the river once again and came to earth in my own grounds at Neuilly. During the whole trip, my greatest altitude was 105 meters, or 346 feet. Taking into consideration that my guide rope hangs 40 meters, or 132 feet below me, and that the top of the Bois trees extend up some 20 meters, or 70 feet from the ground, this extreme altitude left me but 40 meters, or 140 feet, of clear space for vertical maneuvering. It was enough, and the proof of it is that I do not go higher on these trips of pleasure and experiment. Indeed, when I hear of dirigibles going up 400 meters or 1,300 feet in the air without some special justifying object, I am filled with amazement. As I have already explained, the place of the dirigible is normally in low altitudes, and the ideal is to guide rope on a sufficiently low course to be left free from vertical maneuvering. This is what M. Armengaud Jeune referred to in his learned inaugural discourse delivered before the Société Française de Navigation Aérienne in 1901, when he advised me to quit the Mediterranean and go guide roping over great plains like that of La Beauce. It is not necessary to go to the plain of La Beauce. One can guide rope even in the center of Paris, if one goes about it at the proper moment. I have done it. I have guide rope round the Arc de Triomphe and down the Avenue des Champs-Élysées at as low an altitude as the housetops on either side, fearing no ill and finding no difficulty. My first flight of this kind occurred when I sought for the first time to land my number 9 in front of my own house door at the corner of the Avenue des Champs-Élysées and the Rue Washington on Tuesday, the 23rd of June, 1903. Knowing that the feat must be accomplished at an hour when the imposing pleasure promenade of Paris would be least encumbered, I had instructed my men to sleep through the early part of the night in the airship station at Neuilly-Saint-Jean so as to be able to have the number 9 ready for an early start at dawn. I myself rose at 2 a.m., and in my handy electric automobile arrived at the station while it was yet dark. The men still slept. I climbed the wall, waked them, and succeeded in quitting the earth on my first diagonally upward course over the wall and above the River Seine before the day had broken. Turning to the left, I made my way across the bois, picking out the open spaces so as to guide rope as much as possible. When I came to trees, I jumped over them. So, navigating through the cool air of the delicious dawn, I reached the Porte Dauphine and the beginning of the broad Avenue du Bois de Boulogne, which leads directly to the Arc de Triomphe. This carriage promenade of tout Paris was empty. "I will guide rope up the Avenue of the Bois," I said to myself gleefully. What this means, you will perceive when I recall that my guide rope's length is barely 40 meters, or 132 feet, and that one guide rope's best with at least 20 meters, or 66 feet of it, trailing along the ground. Thus, at times, I went lower than the roofs of the houses on each side. I call this practical airship navigation because A. It leaves the aerial navigator free to steer his course without pitching and without care or effort to maintain his steady altitude. B. It can be done with absolute safety from falling, not only to the navigator, but also to the airship. A consideration not without its merit when the cost, both of repairs and hydrogen gas, is taken into count. And C. When the wind is against one, as it was on this occasion, one finds less of it in these low altitudes. So I guide-roped up the Avenue of the Bois. So someday will explorers guide rope to the North Pole from their ice-locked steamship after it has reached its farthest point north. Guide roping over the ice pack, they will make the very few hundreds of miles to the pole at a rate of from 60 to 80 kilometers or 40 to 50 miles per hour. Even at the rate of 50 kilometers or 30 miles, the trip to the pole and back to the ship could be taken between breakfast and supper time. I do not say that they will land the first time at the pole, but they will circle round about the spot, take observations, and return for supper. I might have guide-roped under the Arc de Triomphe had I thought myself worthy. Instead, I rounded the National Monument to the right, as the law directs. Naturally, I had intended to go on straight down the Avenue de Champs-Élysées, but here I met a difficulty. All the avenues meeting at the great star look alike from the airship. Also, they look narrow. I was surprised and confused for a moment, and it was only by looking back to note the situation of the arc that I could find my avenue. Like that of the Bois, it was deserted. Far down its length I saw a solitary cab. As I guide-roped along it to my house at the corner of the Rue Washington, I thought of the time, sure to come, when the owners of handy little airships will not be obliged to land in the street, but will have their guide-ropes caught by their domestics on their own roof-gardens. But such roof-gardens must be broad and unencumbered. So I reached my corner, to which I pointed my stem and descended very gently. Two servants caught, steadied, and held the airship while I mounted to my apartment for a cup of coffee. From my round bay window at the corner, I looked down upon the airship. Were I to receive the municipal permission, it would not be difficult to build an ornamental landing stage out from that window. Projects like these will constitute work for the future. Meanwhile, the aerial idea is making progress. A small boy of 7 years of age has mounted with me in the number 9, and a charming young lady has actually navigated it alone for something like a mile. The boy will surely make an airship captain if he gives his mind to it. The occasion was the children's fete at Bagatelle on the 26th of June, 1903. Descending among them in the number 9, I asked, "Does any little boy want to go up?" Such were the confidence and courage of young France and America that instantly I had to choose among a dozen volunteers. I took the nearest to me. "Are you not afraid?" I asked Clarkson Potter as the airship rose. "Not a bit," he answered. The cruise of the number 9 on this occasion was, naturally, a short one. But the other, in which the first woman to mount, accompanied or unaccompanied, in any airship, actually mounted alone and drove the number 9 free from all human contact with its guide rope for a distance of considerably over a kilometer or half a mile, is worthy of preservation in the annals of aerial navigation. The heroine, a very beautiful young Cuban lady, well known in New York society, having visited my station with her friends on several occasions, confessed an extraordinary desire to navigate the airship. "Would you have the courage to be taken up in the free air with no one holding its guide rope?" I asked. "Mademoiselle, I thank you for the confidence." "Oh, no," she said, "I do not want to be taken up. I want to go up alone and navigate it freely, as you do." I think that the simple fact that I consented, on the condition that she would take a few lessons in the handling of the motor and machinery, speaks eloquently in favor of my own confidence in the number 9. She had 3 such lessons, and then, on the 29th of June, 1903, date that will be memorable in the fasti of dirigible ballooning, rising from my station grounds in the smallest of possible dirigibles, she cried, "Let go, all!" From my station at Neuilly-Saint-Jean, she guide-roped to Bagatelle. The guide-rope, trailing some 10 meters or 30 feet, gave her an altitude and equilibrium that never varied. I will not say that no one ran along beside the dragging guide rope, but certainly no one touched it until the termination of the cruise at Bagatelle, when the moment had arrived to pull down the intrepid girl navigator. End of chapter 22.